We might as well start, even though we don't have a quorum.
Only 3 minutes pass. We had two people muster in ahead of time. Louis was just here. He flashed by. Well, we'll start out with motion to approve. No, we can't do that, can we? Okay, we'll start out with having the legislative auditor's presentation on the Clean Water Fund outcomes reported. Please give your name for the record and start your testimony. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. And we're happy to be here today to talk with you about our evaluation on Clean Water Fund outcomes. We released this report this morning to the Legislative Audit Commission. As you know, in 2008, voters approved the Legacy Amendment, which authorized a statewide sales tax increase and dedicated that increased revenue to four funds, one of which is the Clean Water Fund. When voters approved the Legacy Amendment, they were hoping, presumably, to accomplish a number of things. With regard to the Clean Water Fund, one can assume that they were hoping to get cleaner water. So here we are, 8 years into the Legacy Amendment, and understandably, legislators and stakeholders and others want to know, well, so what's happened? What's happened as a result of the Clean Water Fund? And we are here today to say we can't really tell. And we may never be able to fully measure the outcomes of the Clean Water Fund. And we realize that that's a disappointing message. But there are a number of reasons for it. First of all, in the life cycle of water quality initiatives, it's still early. The state has established a 10-year cycle to monitor, assess, and implement water quality improvement strategies. And we're not yet through the first 10 years. We're still just 8 years in. Secondly, there are a lot of different efforts focused on improving the state's water quality. Clean Water Fund efforts are one such effort, but there are numerous others. So it's nearly impossible to isolate the impacts of just the Clean Water Fund activities themselves. And finally, as you know, there are a lot of different factors that affect water quality, many of which are outside of the state's control. So it could be the fact that the quality of the state's water has remained stable over the past years because of the investment in the Clean Water Fund. So it could be that it required that significant investment merely to remain where we were 8 years ago. But truthfully, we won't be able to isolate whether that was just whatever outcome we have of clean water is because of the Clean Water Fund alone or because of other activities that have happened. So while we can't provide information on some of the key desired outcomes of the Clean Water Fund, we can provide you with a lot of other information, and that's what we plan to do today. For example, we know a lot about how the Clean Water Fund money has been used. We also know the state's progress on some key initiatives, some of which we think will lead us to at least being able to better measure outcomes in the future. We also, in this report, note a recurring theme that we've talked about before when we talk about legacy fund the use of legacy fund money, which is the constant and continuous struggle to understand the constitutional requirement that agencies and stakeholders use legacy money to supplement and not substitute for traditional sources of money. So to hear more about the details of our findings and our recommendations for improvement, I'd like to now turn to Ms. De La Cueva, who is the project manager for our evaluation of the Clean Water Fund outcomes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah De La Cueva, and I'm from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Thank you, to Ms. Randall, for that introduction. I'm pleased to be here today to discuss this report with you on Clean Water Fund outcomes. Before I get started, I would like to thank my colleagues, Will Harrison and Laura Schwartz, sitting behind me, for their hard work on this evaluation. Before we dive into the details, I will just recap our overall key findings, some of which Ms. Randall already mentioned to you. First, it's just too early to report many Clean Water Fund outcomes. But we believe that the state has put in place a framework that's going to allow us to better measure outcomes in the future. Stakeholders continue to struggle with the legal issues of supplement, not substitute, and also the language and appropriation laws that requires that spending be directly related to and necessary for a given appropriation. And finally, the programs funded by the Clean Water Fund, at least for the 2016-17 biennium, all appear to have served purposes specified in the Minnesota Constitution. The Clean Water Fund is important for the state of Minnesota because we have ample water resources to protect. The moniker Land of 10,000 Lakes actually sells us a bit short. We have more than 12,000 lakes of 10 acres or greater in size. We have 100,000 miles of stream. We have wetlands reserves and groundwater reserves. And we organize all this water into drainage basins and watersheds because the water doesn't respect our political boundaries. What we do in one county affects not only the water in that county, but the water everywhere else downstream as well. And so for these, just a quick refresher on what a watershed is, that's all the area of a single area of land that would drain to the same place. So in that dark teal in the left-hand corner, you'll see that's all this area that drains to the Red River of the North eventually. We have 80 major watersheds in Minnesota, and that's a unit of analysis that we use in the report frequently. As Ms. Randall mentioned, the Clean Water Fund was created by the 2008 Legacy Amendment, and it receives 33% of the sales tax proceeds that were created by that voter-approved amendment at that time. Those proceeds may be used only to protect, enhance, and restore water quality and protect drinking water sources. It also, this money helps us meet the provides an ongoing source of funding for the activities required in the 2006 Clean Water Legacy Act, which, among other things, affirms our state's intention to meet federal regulate requirements. The federal requirements that are important to understand are that the state is required to identify impaired waters, which means we need to identify which waters are not meeting state water quality standards and report those to the federal government. Also, for those waters, we must develop total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs. TMDLs are a pollutant diet saying how much of a particular pollutant can be discharged into a particular water body. In addition to affirming the state's intent to meet those federal requirements, the 2006 Clean Water Legacy Act created the Clean Water Council and to help advise on the implementation of the act. The council has 17 voting members appointed by the governor, and they represent various interests, including agricultural interests, business organizations, local governments, environmental organizations, among others. We also have 11 non-voting members, including 7 state agency representatives and 4 legislators. Today, one of the key responsibilities of that council is to make spending recommendations to the governor and the legislature. We observed meetings of the Clean Water Council for a good chunk of 2016 while they were in the midst of preparing their budget for the 2018-19 biennium, their recommendations. And we found that they take their work very seriously and their processes were transparent. We also surveyed stakeholders who agreed with us on those counts. The Clean Water Fund represents a significant investment in Minnesota's water resources. Since 2009, we've appropriated $761 million from the fund. The two biggest chunks of that money go to the Board of Water and Soil Resources with 36% and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency with 27% of all the Clean Water Funds. Since those two get almost two-thirds of the Clean Water Fund dollars, we just chose to focus our evaluation on those two. However, smaller appropriations have also gone to many other state agencies, many of which have water management responsibilities. When discussing outcomes, our first challenge was how to even define outcomes and how to talk about them. There are multiple definitions, but I'm just going to walk you through sort of what we decided using a hypothetical Clean Water Fund example. First, we have a theoretical input of $100,000 Clean Water Fund grant to a county. That allows the county to do an activity, which in this case is the replacement of 50 failing septic systems in low-income homes. That activity will lead to outcomes and hopefully the reduction of harmful bacteria released into groundwater and surface water and reduction of the exposure to sewage for those homeowners. In the long term, we should be able to realize some impacts, but these are going to be much harder to measure and will take longer to realize. As we said at the top of the presentation, you know, we understand that people want to know what the outcomes are of this fund, but it's just too early to say. There's a few good reasons for that. Ms. Randall covered them already, but one that I will talk a little bit more about is the fact that we don't have a lot of baseline data yet for the Clean Water Fund. Before the Clean Water Fund came into effect, we had done some monitoring of the state's waters, usually in response to problems, and they were sporadic efforts, but we really just did not know the condition of most waters in the state. Therefore, we have no early baselines to compare and say that things have improved in the 8 years since the fund started to come into effect. Also, the time frame for water restoration is long. It takes a while to pollute waters, decades, to get waters to the point where we are now. And it's going to take a while for water to respond to whatever interventions we put in place. As we've already discussed, there are multiple funding sources for Clean Water Fund projects, so we may never be able to isolate the impact of the Clean Water Fund alone. And there's also multiple factors that affect the clean water that the state can't control. While we can't measure many outcomes, we believe the state has put a system in place to improve its ability to do so in the future. And this is called the Water Management Framework. This was created by multiple state agencies to help coordinate their responsibilities to manage water. And one component of the effort was the creation of a 5-stage cycle shown here. This cycle is meant to be repeated in every watershed every 10 years. The first stage is monitoring and assessment, which means monitoring is the collection of that water quality data, and assessment is comparing those data to state standards to determine whether the waters are impaired. Stressor identification is determining the causes of the impairments. Strategy development is where we take all the information from the first two phases of the cycle and determine for a particular watershed what strategies are going to work here. Local planning is where soil and water conservation districts, counties, watershed districts, and other local governments take the information from the earlier stages in the cycle and use it to target and prioritize their own list of water quality improvement projects. And finally, those local governments do those projects with Clean Water Fund resources when available and with other resources. In lieu of outcomes, we're going to talk a little bit about the activities completed by the two agencies we evaluated. This gives us an indication of how Clean Water Fund dollars have been spent so far. A large percentage of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's funds have gone towards the responsibilities relating to the first 3 stages of the framework. The PCA has been working through watersheds on the average of about 8 watersheds per year, and it's almost done with the first cycle of monitoring. 93% of the watersheds have been monitored so far, and there's another few left to start this summer. The agency has also assessed 73% of the watersheds. It's done stressor identification for 46% and strategy development for 20%. While the Pollution Control Agency has not made it all the way through the 10-year cycle, the Clean Water Funds have allowed the agency to dramatically increase the pace of these activities. The Board of Water and Soil Resources is more involved in the last 2 stages of the cycle, particularly the ongoing implementation phase, which is what we're going to discuss next. The Board of Water and Soil Resources spends about 70% of its Clean Water Fund dollars on grants to local governments, largely soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, and counties. Since 2010, they've awarded nearly 900 grants, about $136 million total. And those grants have funded nearly 3,000 activities called best management practices, which encompasses a wide array of activities that can help improve water quality, including rain gardens, septic system improvements, feedlot management, among many other things. The state has a couple efforts in place already to report on outcomes for the Clean Water Fund. We reviewed both of these and found a couple of shortcomings about which we make some recommendations. The Clean Water Fund Performance Report is a group effort by the state agencies with water management responsibility. We found that this report, which is produced every 2 years, is a pretty good high-level overview of how Clean Water Fund dollars have been used. However, we have one critique, which is that the report does not provide context for all of the measurements. So it would be useful to have baseline measures or statewide goals to help the reader understand whether the numbers that are presented in the report actually represent significant improvements or just a drop in the bucket. our recommendation is that in future editions of the report, they provide better context for each measure. We also evaluated the Minnesota's Legacy website, which is maintained by the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And this houses data across all four legacy funds, as well as the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. We found that it's useful for learning about individual projects and reading project narratives. However, the site was not designed for and cannot effectively be used for statewide analysis. We make a recommendation to improve the usefulness of the data for doing at least some statewide analysis, and we also make a recommendation to improve state agency reporting, as not all agencies have reported all information required by statute so far. All right. I'd like to switch gears now to discuss the legal issues that I alluded to at the beginning of the presentation and that have been really a subject of debate, both of these, since the Legacy Amendment was passed. The first is known as the supplement, not substitute provision. Specifically, the Minnesota Constitution states that legacy funds must be used to supplement traditional sources of funding and may not be used as a substitute. Direct and necessary is language in the appropriation laws, and has been for the past several years. These laws state that money appropriated in this article may not be spent on activities unless they are directly related to and necessary for a specific appropriation. Both of these issues continue to cause confusion, and we heard them debated frequently throughout our evaluation. Earlier this year, our office's Financial Audit Division released a report on noncompliance related to legacy spending, and they, too, identified these issues as ongoing points of confusion. Unfortunately, we did not come up with any amazing new guidance on these issues. In Chapter 5 of our report, we provide a primer, a sort of a history on the problems with the supplement, not substitute, and why it's been so debated over the years. However, we offer one small recommendation related to that and one small recommendation related to the direct and necessary provision as well. We don't think these are going to end all the debate on the issues, but they may help improve the clarity of certain aspects. With respect to supplement, not substitute, last session, the legislature enacted a new requirement for two of the four legacy funds. For the Parks and Trails and Arts and Cultural Heritage Funds, there was new language required any organization requesting an appropriation from one of those funds to inform the legislature whether the request is a substitution for any previous funding source used for that purpose. The legislature did not enact a similar requirement for the Clean Water Fund or the Outdoor Heritage Fund. We recommend that if the legislature finds this new approach to be useful for those two funds, that it adopts similar approach for the Clean Water Fund, because we believe this is an important form of legislative oversight. We also heard a lot of debate about the direct and necessary requirement, and we think that at least a part of the confusion stems from the difference between the colloquial and accounting definitions of the word indirect. The use of the term indirect cost, meaning administrative costs, has led some to believe that it is the opposite of direct and therefore cannot be paid with clean water funds. We disagree that this is the case. In accounting, indirect refers to a method of billing expenses. Administrative costs can be billed either directly or indirectly. If you think about your photocopies, you could put tracking equipment on a machine and have everybody enter their program code, and that would be a direct link and a direct way to bill those photocopies. Or you can not have that tracking equipment and just estimate that I think 10% of the copies that we make pertain to this fund, and that would be an indirect billing method. With the billing method that an agency chooses to use does not affect whether or not those copies are actually related to the program. We think that the legislature could alleviate this confusion by making a small addition to future appropriation laws, just clarifying that administrative expenditures may be appropriate if they are directly related to and necessary for the programs. The final legal issue we examined proved to be much less controversial. We evaluated every appropriation made for the 2016-17 biennium to determine whether it met the constitutional purposes of protecting, enhancing, and restoring water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, and protecting groundwater. We found that the appropriation language for each of these clearly intended to meet these purposes. Further, we calculated the percentage of the appropriations that were intended to protect drinking water sources to determine whether at least 5% of the funds were spent for this purpose as required by the Constitution. Again, we found that things were okay here. We found that more than 5% of the appropriations served this purpose, which satisfies the constitutional requirement. On that positive note, I'm going to end my remarks, and I'm happy to take any questions from the audience of members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of your recommendations on page 6 is to provide better context.
Yes.
And I look at this and think that's the most important recommendation you're making. In business school, I think they teach people you can't manage what you don't measure, or something akin to that. Mm-hmm. And we haven't measured our problems, so we haven't. So we don't know when we make an appropriation whether you're solving this much of the problem is this big, or this much of the problem. So we have no idea how we're doing. So I particularly appreciate that, and hope that that becomes routine. One of my concerns about the report is in the constitutional purposes to protect groundwater from degradation. There's nothing in here about that. 75% of Minnesotans drink groundwater. That's their source of drinking water. And we don't have anything for groundwater like we have for lakes, rivers, and streams. So the Constitution actually has two pieces for groundwater, at least 5%. It's just not 5%. But it's also protect groundwater from degradation. So it seems that one of the recommendations should be having something like this for drinking water. So that was a huge concern when I looked at your report, that we're missing. We're still concentrating on lakes, rivers, and streams. And in concentrating on lakes, rivers, and streams, we're still missing drinking water, so that 25% of people who don't drink groundwater drink river water. But nobody in this state is measuring, say, the Mississippi for the contaminants that may contaminate drinking water. There's some spot checks that PCA just did a report on pharmaceuticals and other essentially endocrine disruptors. But that was a spot check just to see what was out there. And there's a lot out there. But we're not monitoring the Mississippi for those kinds of things, which, I think we'd all agree we don't want our kids drinking somebody else's drugs. I mean, that makes no sense. But we're not monitoring for it as routine. So when you're talking about having no baseline data, we still don't have baseline data for drinking water. So those are some things I just point out. This is a big issue, but we haven't defined it very well yet. So hopefully, as you all are going forward, you'll help us with that definition of what's the size, what's the problem.
Mm-hmm. You have any response? Or?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius. I absolutely acknowledge that, yes, we did not focus on groundwater and drinking water in this report. Unfortunately, the Clean Water Fund is an enormous issue, and we needed to scope it down. And where so far we have gone with where most of the money went, which was to the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and they admittedly are not spending most of their money on groundwater, so it wasn't something that we got to spend a lot of time with. Though I certainly acknowledge and recognize that it is a very important issue. I know that some of there is at least some amount of money, and I don't know how much off the top of my head, spent on the GRAPS initiative, and it's Groundwater Restoration and Protection Strategies. So it's sort of the equivalent to the strategy development portion of the framework that I talked about for lakes, rivers, and streams. My understanding, though, is that that may be sort of a pilot phase. Hopefully it's something that the state will expand in the future.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wonderful presentation. Since we have a quorum here, has anybody read the minutes of the March 13th meeting yet? Approval of the March 13th minutes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Minutes, appreciated that. Next we have House File 2405, Representative Petersburg. Well done.
Yep.
Sure. I will move House File 2405 to be included in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing this bill. This bill is very similar to, I think, others.
We laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Thank you for the clarification. This bill is very similar to bills that you've heard before. Basically, it requests a $50,000 grant to Waseca County for completing the Waseca County Veterans Memorial. We have money collected already, and this should finish up the project. I do have a person here that I think has submitted some data or some handouts for you as well, and we could certainly stand for more questions if you would like.
Very well. Welcome to our committee.
It's good to be here. My name is Harry Popiel. I'm a retired Air Force officer, and 50 years ago this week, I started my active duty commitment to the Air Force in Duluth, which at that time was referred to by the base commander as Dogpatch Air Force Base because it's pretty low on the funding priority. So you learned frugality when on in the service. I served 4 years active duty and then 16 in the active reserve. So pleased to be here. We're talking about a memorial to supplement the last memorial that was built in 1941. There's been no memorial to honor veterans of World War II and any subsequent conflict. So that's why this project got started. When I got involved in this in January of 2013, we had $50 in the bank. No architectural renderings, no site approved, and that sort of thing. We got through all of that process. And in the sheet, the second sheet, it shows the rendering of what this new memorial is going to look like. It's across the street from the side of the courthouse, a new location that we had to get to because we were really running into some problems trying to site this thing on the courthouse lawn. It was just inadequate space, and some preservationists were against this, so we worked out our differences. SHPO had corrected some misperceptions down there, and that's why the site is as proposed. What you're seeing there, the rendering was finished on January 17th of this year, so it's fresh, it's finalized, and the next page shows the monument portion. Monument portion, black granite, by the way, is not quarried in the U.S. It comes from either mainland China or from India. We selected India. The vendor that we use for the monument pieces is John Hiram at Owatonna Granite, and the source comes from Rock of Ages up around St. Cloud. The six medallions that you see there are four for the branches, regular branches of service, and then two additional, Coast Guard and Merchant Marines. Financial update in terms of the income and expense, just briefly, I highlighted that in yellow. This shows the 3 years or 4 years that we've been operating since we reconstituted the committee. The first year we raised $23,800. That was primarily because of funding through the Waseca Area Foundation and the Rosenhaus, who netted $55 million in the lottery, and they've been really generous with all kinds of philanthropic things. So that got us started. The next year was kind of shaky because we weren't sure whether this was going to continue because of the Heritage Preservation Commission. Since we were within the city, we found out that we were accountable to them. So we worked that through. The city council overruled the Heritage Preservation Commission. We got final approval toward the end of the year. By the end of October, we knew that for sure we had an opportunity to build this thing as a county project within the city. The big year in terms of fundraising was in 2015. We raised $92,900 that year. Felt pretty good about that. Last year we raised $31,000. And the total amount that we've raised is $151,000. That's actually more about $160,000. These are numbers through the end of the year, ended 2016. We're pretty frugal. None of us that have worked on this thing have incurred any reimbursement for any of our personal expenses, and several of us have donated a significant amount of money, which we're glad to do. All of these people, except one, is a veteran, but we have a great deal of empathy on the part of all the people now that they have bought into this. So our net income, which is the actual revenue raised that's net, it shows that 149, I think we're at about 158 as we speak today. The next page shows the construction budget. ISG, the architect who's doing this work for us, was working for Paulson Architects in Mankato when we lined this up. And through good talking, Paulson Architects had done a lot of philanthropy. They did the repurposing of the train station down in Wells. The architect that we're using has worked with us through this project so far, and we can't say enough thanks to Tammy and Brian Paulson. They were supporting us, and then they sold their business to ISG. ISG continues to help us. The budget, construction budget, revised as of January 17th of this year, is $243,000. And you can look at that at your convenience. The $80,000 that shows, or actually more like $115,000, is the cost of the granite. The granite has already been sourced, and it's in-house up in Quebec. We found a vendor up in Quebec that does laser etching and veterans' monuments and other memorials, found us on their website. And one day, this lady called me one day who owns the firm, asked if they could help us. And I said, well, we have $50 in the bank, no site approved, no design approved at that point. She said, we'll work with you. Not only did they work with us, but they sourced some granite for us at one of the six quarries north of the border, north of Burlington, Vermont. And when we tried to run those numbers with the other alternatives in country here, we couldn't find a vendor that would quote a price anything close to what they quoted. They're doing a great job up in Cloquet at the moment. They were working on the details of that last fall, and I think when warm weather hits finally, they're going to be starting construction up there. But working with them, we eliminated $230,000 of cost on this project. The initial estimate in 2013, was $499,000. By the middle of that year, by going to laser etching and with the granite sources for the six tablets that hold the plaques, we were able to reduce the cost by $230,000. So by working with good vendors, they stayed with us. By the good architectural work that we got from ISG and continues to the support that we continue to get, this is what we think, in comparison to other memorials that we've looked at around the country and in southern Minnesota, we think we have a very good design. We got very good support from particularly Wells. Maynard Heitner, who was a retired mortician down there, was one of the co-chairs of that project. He was very helpful to us in working us through some of the details. And then Mel Reuter, a retired veteran of the Marine Corps, was able to get us able to offer us some ideas in terms of the design. So if you look on the next page, that's the balance sheet as of December 31st. Total assets, what, like I mentioned earlier, it's now at about 158. The funds to be raised, that's the reason why we're here today, the construction budget of 243 less the total assets, and these are, again, December 31st figures, showed a need of $93,000. We have some projected savings as a result of the new location where this project is going to be built, and there's no utility line relocations and flagpole savings through buying these things through a guy that we know. That reduces the net amount to be raised to $75,000. Why aren't we asking for $75,000? Because this is a project that's a grassroots effort. We didn't even want to come and have to ask for money here, but we need your help, and that's the long and the short of it. Any questions on anything that I covered?
Any questions from the members? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative, thank you for bringing this. I have a sweet spot in my heart for these things. A couple of years ago, though, in Legacy, we did do small grants, but I'm not familiar of us doing very many of these through Legacy, and my community was able to get additional funding, and then the representatives from Edina was able to get some for theirs too, I think, and then some others around the state through capital investment. So I hope you're pursuing like a dual track system, and because, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense. It really looks great, sure, what you're doing, and it'll really be a blessing on you know, for your community if you're able to get her done. And I'm sure you will, one way or another. But these things are great, and it seems like you might want to look at capital investment too. And I really hope that we can get that delivered for you.
Representative Lehman.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too would like to compliment you. It's not often you get such complete financial information. So you really did a nice job. It's really helpful to detail out exactly where the funds have come from and what the ask is. And you answered my other question. I was just thinking if the Legacy Fund and how many veterans memorials there are, we could quickly utilize a good portion of the funds. But a question for you is this the only memorial in Waseca County?
Yes.
It is.
The only, and this is a county memorial rather than a community memorial.
Mm-hmm.
I should explain, Janesville built their own a few years ago, and that's the only one that's been built in recent years. There have been a total of about 20 memorials built in southern Minnesota, and the largest one is over in Rochester. Wayne Stillman, the gentleman who chaired that project over there, they started with a $4 million requirement. They ended up with a $2 million thing because of some economies that they realized. That's a wonderful place. I mean, it's like an educational setting where you go in and look at laser etchings that show combat scenes from different wars and so forth. It's an amazing, amazing thing. Just to pick up on something, we've been in a fundraising mode looking at large organizations primarily. The company that I worked for, Brown Printing Company, was sold by its German owners in 2014. Brown donated a quarter of, this sounds like a commercial for the company that's no longer in Waseca, but they donated a quarter of a million between the projects for the water park and the hockey arena. If they had been here, I was the vice president of human resources for them for 23 years. They're gone now. And the new owner has reduced the workforce by 50%. They're down to about 450 from 900 when I retired in 2009. So that's a funding source that no longer exists. Frankly, we approached three other organizations. One, I can tell you, Canadian Pacific, took 15 months, and we passed first muster with them. We had to apply to their headquarters in Calgary. And just a couple months ago, they told us that we didn't pass the final test. So that was a big disappointment. Another, Itron, a company in Waseca, changed their criteria. They no longer cover veterans' memorials. And they changed that after we had applied a few years ago. The other one is Mayo Clinic. Mayo Clinic told me that this was the most compelling application that they had seen, but when the committee reviewed it, they all agreed, the donation committee in Rochester, that they said they were worried about going outside of Olmsted County because they thought maybe they'd get a flood of requests. So we're still trying to work with Mayo Clinic Health Systems because Mayo Clinic Health Systems told us that they weren't part of Mayo Clinic, and we said, well, the name would kind of imply that there's a more than a casual working relationship. So we're still hopeful, and we found out, don't tell anybody this, but the guy who now just moved recently over to run the Mankato operations, all the southern Minnesota operations, was born in Waterville. And, of course, that's north of Waseca County, but Waseca County has an outright, or, you know, an outpost in Waterville.
It's not on public record, by the way.
What's that?
It's now on public record, by the way.
Oh, okay. So anyway, that's the funding we continue to look at, but 50,000 of what we've collected so far came from veterans and their families, okay? There's a very strong interest, and I was going through the list of donations, just eyeballing that, there's probably another 30,000 of that who came from either individuals or the Legion, the VFW Post. So We're digging as deeply as we can, and we've found people really. I grew up in a, not to bore you with a lot of stuff, but I grew up in an area of upstate New York. I used to tell people I was from New York, and they used to look at me like, who is this guy? And it was rural, dairy farming, and so forth. This thing would not have been dependent on private, or, you know, donations. It would have been units of government that would have done that. But the world is different, and we understand that. And we find out sometimes when you talk to people, people who have no connection to the veterans community are not real crazy about building a veterans memorial. So it's been an educational opportunity. The people that I've talked to are people that are people who lost people during the war. They're buried in military graveyards overseas. They see this project as a very deserving thing, so that's why I'm an advocate. I don't like to ask people for money, but having to do this isn't really as painful as it was when we first got started. So I appreciate, and I know you're running out of time, so thank you for the opportunity to come over here today.
Any other questions? Seeing none, again, I will renew my motion to have House File 2405 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very much for an enlightening presentation.
Thanks.
And I think it's all of next Monday. Well, next Monday we'll do a walkthrough of our bill and take public testimony.
And then
And we'll probably mark up the bill at night, unless we can get it done during our committee period. So bring your fast-thinking hats on. With that, we are adjourned. Mm-hmm.